every memo from every lawyer urging staying on the safe side, all that just phonied the business up. The internet was a force of disintermediation, as we used to say. It's not just that it let us deal directly with the people building the stuff we wanted to buy. The internet was disintermediating the sedimentary layers of increasing non-humanity. Person to person is also human to human, with no institutional assholism in the picture. It turns out we were basically right. The internet does indeed let us connect human to human. We do root around a-holes on the net. Business has been changed, often in ways that are invisible to us because we take them for granted. Basically right, but not entirely. Beyond the triumphalist overstatements, Thesis 74, we are immune to advertising, just forget it, which at least had a rhetorical purpose, we were wrong about how long it was going to take to throw the rascals out. Speaking for myself, as we four authors always do, I naively underestimated how resourceful the incumbents would be in resisting the change. Only 3 years ago, my friend Ethan Zuckerman and I drafted an article arguing that anonymity ought to remain the default on the internet. Coalitions were gathering, some trying to keep us safe, others wanting to chill speech they don't like, to make it impossible for anyone to use the internet without identifying herself in traceable ways. Our manuscript pointed to the very positive effects of keeping anonymity as the norm on the web. We closed by spinning out what would have to happen to prevent a determined and somewhat technical evildoer from keeping his or her communications private. You'd have to lock down computers so only officially approved applications could be loaded. You'd have to register programming tools as if they were guns. You'd have to pass and enforce laws requiring internet cafes to demand strong identification from users. You'd have to monitor all traffic using deep packet inspection that looks for suspicious words in every communication, and so on. It was, we thought, a catalog of absurdities, requiring such significant changes in hardware, software, laws, and culture that no one would think it possible. Ethan and I put the article aside for no particular reason. I went back to it recently and discovered that our list of ridiculous conditions were now being considered and sometimes implemented. The net that the Clue Train celebrated is in danger. The risk is serious. It threatens what is most valuable and transformative about the internet, the way it lets us create new ways of connecting, one to some, many to many, and in menage a whatevers we haven't yet invented. Of course, that threat, promise, of transformation is exactly what spurs incumbent institutions to oppose it. So let's first get good and depressed by looking at the threats that Clue Train did not foresee back in the days when oats were oats and the internet was our inevitable future, and then we can talk about our duty to be optimistic. Part 1. Threats of, by, and for the people. The roster of threats is daunting, including some of the most powerful institutional forces in our culture. Gulp. 1. The access providers. The folks who have been charged with providing the internet to the citizenry of the United States of America love the internet, the same way a real estate developer loves an old-growth forest with a mountain view. A few years ago, I was invited to give a talk at a cable industry conference. They scheduled me for an afternoon keynote. That morning, I used my name badge to attend a panel of CEOs and senior managers. As they waxed enthusiastic about the challenges ahead, my spirits sank. I had known they wanted to turn the internet into cable TV, but I hadn't realized the unassailable coherence of their point of view. To them, the internet is a new way to deliver content and services. It makes more content available, the content is available on demand, and new services such as internet telephony can be layered in as they are invented. But the internet has one huge disadvantage from the viewpoint of these very serious men. The customer experience sucks. The programming isn't anywhere near high-def quality, telephone calls can sound like the cable is made out of connected kazoos, and everything is too hard to do. Therefore, the cable industry's mandate has all the force of a syllogism. Make the internet as easy to use and as high quality as cable TV. This makes perfect sense given two suppositions. First, you have to assume that the internet is primarily there to deliver content. Second, you have to be willing to sacrifice everything else to that goal. Or, put differently, this makes perfect sense if you're willing to be entirely wrong about the internet. Every meme-flogging blogger and every pixel-pushing artist would agree that the net is a way to deliver content. The problem is with the word primarily. The very characteristic that distinguishes the internet from all other media is that it isn't primarily for any particular use. It just moves bits from any A to any B. Some of those bits are content of the sort we get on TV, but some are muzzle flashes in an online game, some are EKGs, and yes, many are conversations. The internet is for anything we can do by putting bits in motion. Once we decide that the internet is primarily for one purpose, we then rationally have to give precedence and priority to that purpose. As internet architect David Reed says, optimizing for one purpose means de-optimizing for all others. So there goes user choice, and there goes the ability to innovate tomorrow's new service on an equal footing with today's. If you think the internet is primarily for delivering professional video content, you speed up video bits, which means slowing down YouTube bits, as well as every other non-professional video. If you think your customers want an easy-to-use internet, you herd them into your own portal onto the net, which means your company decides which services are too hard for your poor, dumb customers, which means the open market for good ideas, some of which may require more intelligence than it takes to press a TV remote, has been skewed in favor of the lowest and commonest of the denominators. If you have decided that the net's real purpose is to keep us fat and happy on our couches, bathed in the warm glow of messages from our sponsors, you give your customers the ability to download bits many times faster than they can upload them. That tells you exactly how conversational they think the net is. Not very. The panel of well-groomed, middle-aged men I was listening to that day didn't think they hated the internet. They thought they had gotten past their initial denial and had gone all the way to enthusiasm. The internet is, in their word of choice, an opportunity. They just have to clear-cut the forest, pull up the stumps, rototill the remaining land, lay down some sod, and they'll have the suburban box of which every American dreams. Let's hear it for the stumps. 2. The content cartel and its enablers. If you think the value of the internet is the value of the content on it, then you likely think of copyright as your warrior king. In this way, copyright becomes the first among all rights, and thus does it twist our culture around its bony fingers. Of course, copyright serves a purpose. Quote, "The Congress shall have power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries." Unquote. Our forefathers wrote that in beautiful script in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of our Constitution. Copyright exists to provide an incentive to creators to continue creating. Yet no one can argue that a writer would be too discouraged to write a book if copyright didn't deliver a royalty check to her graveside address a full 70 years after she's put up her personal RIP sign. Copyright's current death plus 70 term thus has nothing to do with incentives. Rather, copyright now exists in its current form to prop up industries that used to benefit from the natural scarcity of material goods. Now that creative works are plentiful, copyright tries through law to reinstate a scarcity that technology has obviated and that the market has repudiated. The evidence of this is all around us. Computing systems lock us out of reusing content even in quite legal ways by baking digital rights management, or DRM, capabilities into their operating systems and hardware. One provider of internet access, AT&T, has announced it will patrol its network for what it considers to be infringing material. Apple iTunes has required you to hack your own computer to transfer songs from one machine to another, and Apple's iStore only lets you install iPhone software that it has approved. None of this is surprising. The entertainment industry now includes not only the movie makers, but the network providers and the software and hardware manufacturers, and they all have an interest in keeping their content scarce, even if it means that culture now runs into a dead end, and our progress in science and the lively arts is throttled so the mainstream can continue to dazzle us with its retreads and safe bets. If we took as our goal the maximum flowering of culture, rather than protecting the interests of a tiny handful of producers and publishers, we could have a world full of music and creativity. 3. Government. When governments think about security, the internet looms as an enabler of their worst fears. Against the image of a city getting nuked, the arguments in favor of an open internet have no purchase. What good does it do to be able to chat, update your Facebook page, and enter market conversations if you're a wet spot in a crater? It's a tough argument to counter because, taken in itself, it's entirely right. There are many bad actors out there, from the perpetrators of botnets to actual goddamn terrorists. Preferring to be vaporized rather than lose your right to download porn automatically classifies you at the far end of the spectrum of obsessive masturbators. The fear of bad actors, however, is used by police states to justify every conceivable limitation of rights. And in fact, we are not facing a choice between watching our children get blown up or limiting net freedoms. Rather, we are facing a choice between a risk of attack and our freedom to speak, read, and connect, also to masturbate. That's a harder balance to strike, but we in Western democracies have tended to give much greater weight to freedom than to fear. One reason we've favored freedom is that maintaining a totalitarian regime is a pain in the butt. You have to recruit spies to infiltrate neighborhood groups. You have to steam open letters. On every street corner, you have to station men with Uzis in their hands and death symbols on their caps. Real-world totalitarianism is a full-time job for a regime. But on the net, you can get the rudiments of a police state up and running in just about no time, and the bulk of the work can be done auto-magically. Centralize the ISPs. Require people to log in with their official state identification number. Do deep packet inspection to look for transmissions using the sorts of words used by enemies of the state and music freeloaders. Investigate anyone who encrypts messages. Totalitarians get much more bang for their buck online. So, the new levels of threat have surfaced just as total surveillance has become far easier. To complicate the matter further, we have a new sense of privacy that defaults to making things public in the hope that with so much available, no one will notice that photo of me half-naked and drunk down on Fisherman's Wharf. So what the hell? Let the robot squad check my text messages for suspicious phrases if the alternative is being indirectly responsible for the next terrorist attack. I personally am not an absolutist about this. I would rather not die, and I feel some obligation to my children to prevent them from being flambéed. There are some government intrusions that don't bother me as much as they bother my fellow travelers, but I do fear the slippery slope of trading freedom for security. Unlike most slippery slopes, if we let homos marry, next thing you know we'll be letting people marry their cats, to paraphrase Rick Santorum, this slope we know historically is genuinely slippery. It's a short distance between deep packet inspection and putting suspicious people on the no-fly list. And there's no distance at all between putting people on lists and chilling free speech. Freedom, we seem to think, is no longer worth the risk. 4. The people who sell us stuff. Doc's phrase, markets are conversations, is so powerful that it tends to wipe the mind clean of any other idea in the Clue Train Manifesto. And I think the phrase is right. Markets are conversations. With that phrase in mind, newly web-savvy marketers have marched proudly forward and made a mess of things. Some have done so with good intentions. They believe what they read in Clue Train or elsewhere. They understand that networked markets are usually the best source of information about products and services. They feel humbled and want to start talking in human voices, but they don't know how to. They don't have a sense for the ethos of the web conversations they're jumping into. They don't have the patience to lurk and learn, so they embarrass themselves. It's painful to watch, say, Wrigley's Gum introduce a blog in which two made-up characters express their unhealthy obsession with chewable candy. Or there's the fun of watching Doritos jump on the Web 2.0 bandwagon by offering Super Bowl airtime to the best user-generated commercial, only to pick an ad as slick as one churned out by a professional shop, and then to find out that the ad was, in fact, created by an advertising professional. Such farcical behavior mirrors what some comedian once said about airline food. It's as if aliens saw pictures of food and knew nothing else about it. But some marketers do not have good intentions. They are not stumbling on a path that overall is righteous and commendable. They see something of value and wish to corrupt it. They pay people to wax enthusiastic about their products in comments around the web without acknowledging the payment. They set up phony blogs. They take advantage of the anonymity that protects genuinely risky speech. They erode the trust that enables us to converse, and for that they should rot in some outer circle of hell. Sure, some of them get caught at it, but by definition, we don't know how many get away with it. Just as the open internet paradoxically enables governments to spy on citizens' online behavior, market conversations can provide cover for lying sacks of ordure. Conversations assume trust and thus are quite corruptible. And for that reason, predatory, opaque marketing is a threat to the heart of the net's value as how we connect with one another. 5. The digital divide. The fact that access to the internet falls out generally along the old tired lines of economic class and ethnicity is unfortunate, sad, and predictable. This failure of the internet is due to its being nestled within a real and wildly unfair world. In fact, the link between atoms and unfairness is well nigh unbreakable. So we have a digital divide that prevents the internet from being all it can be. Worse, we will always have a digital divide of some sort, even if, when, everyone is connected, some will be more connected than others. Some will have fast broadband and big screens, and others will be using those people's cast-offs. Some will have the skills required, the media literacy, the social skills, even the words-per-minute typing skills, and some will not. Still, there's an essential difference between having a slow connection and having no connection. Fortunately, of all the various divides, the digital one is one of the easier ones to overcome. We'll get everyone on the planet a handset, some bandwidth, and some basic net skills well before we've ended the economic, ethnic, or gender divides. 6. People. The Cloutrain Manifesto painted a very positive picture of the internet, to say the least. I'm okay with that. We wanted to explain what netizens were so excited about and what businesses insisting that the net changed nothing was causing them to miss. Pushback was inevitable, especially if you're thinking of the internet as primarily being about content, and pushback is entirely proper. One of the strongest arguments against the transformative power of the net has been that the internet doesn't make us more open to diversity. In fact, the argument goes, the net is enticing us to hunker down with people who believe exactly the same things as we do, thus battening down our beliefs rather than opening them up. If that's right, then our own discomfort with difference is a serious threat to the value of the internet. What would it take to settle the argument? The maps of links among sites do indeed show that some sites are hubs and have many more links than others. When it comes to political sites, we seem to cluster around a relative handful of partisan places. But link maps don't tell the whole story. We don't know people's actual reading habits. Do the people who hang out in these clusters only hang out there? Does the homogeneity of the clustering vary by topic? Does it vary by political stance, by demographic data, by the urgency or freshness of the issue? Let's say we answer those questions. Let's say we know, on average, how many different sorts of sites people traverse, what sorts of mailing lists they're on, and who they hang out with on their social networking sites. We still wouldn't know if the internet is making us more or less diverse because we don't have a baseline against which to compare this data, since in the United States, newspaper op-eds run the entire spectrum of political thought from forest green to light forest green. Are we sure that our daily papers are more diverse than these web clusters? Do people read their newspapers end to end, or do they skip the articles and editorials they don't care for and focus on those they agree with? If newspapers form our baseline, how do we figure out what the baseline actually is? Maybe we should compare the internet not to newspapers, but to the conversations we have in the real world. How diverse are they? If we could listen in, we'd probably find that people talk with those who are more like them than unlike. Indeed, conversation requires a broad base of agreement from which we then discuss relatively minor differences. Conversation isn't usually about finding the truth. It's a social activity and a way of building social relationships. Those who despair that we are living in net bunkers may well have an unrealistic view of the role of conversation. So, to decide whether the net is making us more or less open to diversity, we'd have to answer an ever-deepening series of questions that begin with the empirical. What actually is the spread of net experiences when it comes to encountering the unfamiliar? And descend into the socio-philosophical. What is the role of conversation? When the bottom drops out of a question as simple as this, we should worry that there's something wrong with the question itself. But assume for the moment that the cynics have a legitimate concern, for they do. If they are right that the net hardens our hearts and our minds, Our possibly innate preference for similarity over difference would make human nature itself the most powerful enemy of the Internet ever. Oh, great. Part 2. Rainbows, Kitty Cats, and Cyber-Utopianism. Here's the executive summary of Part 1. The beautiful promise of the Internet is heading for the crapper. Like my ex-hippie generation that twice elected George Bush, we're about to blow it, big time. But here's the executive summary of Part 2. Don't worry, be happy. Among the three major attitudes toward the Internet, choose the happiest. It's not just more fun, it's your duty. That would make you a cyber-utopian, much like the authors of the Kloutrain Manifesto in 1999. This tribe points to the ways in which the net has changed basic assumptions about how we live together, removing old obstacles and enabling shiny new possibilities. Of course, you could become a cyber dystopian who agrees that the net is having a major effect on our lives, but you think the effect is detrimental. Finally, you could become a cyber realist who pooh-poohs the magnitude of effect that has so awed the utopians and the dystopians. As a cyber realist, you would say that the possibilities and limitations of the net are really not so much greater than those of any other major communications medium. So who's right? Consider this hypothetical exchange. Realist. You say that the web will transform politics, but politics is the same as it ever was. Utopian. Just wait. This is indeed one of the two basic blocking tactics used by cyber utopians. The changes are so important that they will take a while to arrive. Here's an example of a second utopian tactic at work. Realist. You say that the web will transform business, but business is the same as it ever was. Utopian. Not at all. For example, email has transformed meetings, but we're so used to the change that we don't even recognize it. To this, the cyber realist has a number of responses, denying that the changes are real, that they are important, or that they are due to the web. When a dystopian points to a bad effect of the web, the utopian denies the claim's truth, inevitability, or importance. Dystopian. The web has made pornography available to every schoolchild. Utopian. It is the responsibility of parents to make sure their kids are using child-safe filters. Besides, viewing pornography may weaken our unhealthy anti-sex attitudes. Besides, greater access to porn is just one effect of the web. It's brought greater access to literature, art, science. But surely someone has to be right about whether the Internet sucks or is our savior. How about gathering some facts? Fine. Which ones? Do we take a company caught paying customers to write positive blog posts as an aberration or as typical? Do we focus on the presence of online child porn or online assistance for new parents? Do we put forward forums where grieving parents support one another or flame fests where cretins drive each other to new depths? Facts are of little avail because utopians, dystopians, and realists have different views of history, and the framing of history also frames facts. Utopians and dystopians think the web has uncanny power because they are closet McLuhanites who think media transform institutions and even consciousness. Realists feel the inertial weight of existing institutions and social structures, and thus tend to think any changes the Internet brings will be slow and minimal. After all, say the realists, nothing as trivial as HTML will change the fact that corporations are firmly in control, and that much of the world lives in helpless poverty. One's view of history frames the facts one attends to. Facts are therefore unlikely to upend one's historical frame. Indeed, these three stances are political, not factual. Utopians want to excite us about the future possibilities because they want policies that will keep the Internet an open field for bottom-up innovation. Dystopians want to warn us of the dangers of the web so we can create policies and practices that will mitigate those dangers. Realists want to clear away false promises so people don't fritter away time on airy-fairy projects that will lead nowhere. Also, they'd like the blowhard utopians to just shut up for a while. From these positions flow practical policies. If the cyber-utopians are right that the Internet is transformative in an overall positive way, the most basic premise of the original Kloutrain, then it's thus morally incumbent on us to provide widespread access and training to as much of the world as possible, focusing on the disadvantaged. If the dystopians are right, we should put the brakes on access and immediately put in place whatever safeguards we can. If the realists are right, then we ought to make tactical adjustments and ignore the hyperventilations of the utopians and dystopians. If the web is transforming business for better, utopian, or for worse, dystopian, then businesses need to alter their strategic plans. If the web is merely one more way information travels, realist, then businesses should learn the techniques for taking advantage of the new channel, but do nothing more. If we cannot choose among these three attitudes based solely on facts, then how do we choose? I suggest that we pick the one with the best outcome. On those grounds, dystopianism is out of luck. It's fear-based and depressing. How are you going to run a business with Eeyore and Chicken Little as your role models? That leaves utopianism and realism. Realism has the better name. It sounds like it has to be more in touch with reality. But what realist would have thought that Wikipedia was worth the time or investment? What realist would have said, "Yeah, getting a disorganized mob to build an operating system to compete with Microsoft is a terrifically practical idea"? What realist would have said in 1992, "I've seen Tim Berners-Lee's plan for a World Wide Web, and realistically, in 10 years there will be a billion people on it and hundreds of billions of pages"? A premature realism would have killed the web. Who knows what earth-shaking ideas are right now being laughed off the net by confident realists? Realism just isn't ambitious enough. And for exactly the same reasons, utopianism is the net's ally. Realists are right more often than utopians are, because most ideas are bad. But without utopianism, the ideas that are so good that they change the world would never get the air they need. Utopians have made more of the Internet than any reasonable person could have expected. Utopians rule. Of course we need realists. Innovation requires the realism that keeps us from wasting time on the impossible. Realists keep us from running down dead ends longer than we need to, and from getting into feedback loops that distort the innovation process. At the nittier-grittier levels of provisioning Internet services, hardcore realists with bits under their fingernails are a godsend. For all that and more, we should thank and encourage the realists. But realists are not enough. Besides, realism already has a good name. You don't have to convince anyone that realism is a good thing. Utopianism, on the other hand, has a bad name. We need to stand by our utopians so they can drive us into the impossible future. We need lots and lots of them. There is so much yet to invent. Yes, I admit the whole argument is essentially silly. We don't get to choose whether we're realists, optimists, or pessimists any more than we get to choose if we're born in Albany or Beijing. We're pretty much stuck with who we are. We're also stuck in a culture we didn't choose to be born into, a family that raised us, a language that divvies up and links the world one way and not another, experiences that happen to us whether we like them or not, all on a planet that turns out to be good for growing delicious plants, but that has the occasional lethal crevasse. That's the sort of stuck we are. So I'm not really arguing that 90% of us ought to become cyber-utopians and 10% should become realists, or whatever the optimal mix may be. Rather, the implicit and basic utopianism of the Kloutrain Manifesto, and far more importantly, of the hundreds of millions of people on the Internet, was helpful, important, and, as Martha herself would say, a good thing. It is not yet time to let a forlorn realism reign. Part 3. What to do? So, with our new sense of optimism in charge, in Part 3, let's look back at the threats adumbrated in Part 1. Those threats are real. I underestimated them in my contributions to the Kloutrain Manifesto 10 years ago. But the main lesson I've learned, or at least I think it's a lesson and not just my delusion du jour, is not that cyber-utopianism is wrong. It's that the values of the Internet won't become real without our help. Let's revisit each of the threats from the first section. 1. The access providers. It wouldn't be all that hard to keep the access providers from being able to decide that content, especially their content, is what the Internet is really for. Net neutrality legislation would forbid them from giving their content and services precedence over anyone else's. Of course, the providers have a history of simply ignoring laws and policies that don't suit them. So we could, for example, once again require net access providers to give competitors access to their lines at wholesale prices. We'd once again have thousands of ISPs outdoing themselves to offer us competitive deals. Or we could decide that access to the Internet provides such an important advantage, economically, educationally, socially, politically, that the federal government has to step in to build national bitways just as in the 1950s it built national highways. There are lots of potential configurations for accomplishing this, but all of them implicitly acknowledge that the way we're doing it now is not serving our national weal. With a new administration just having been elected as I write this, November 2008, perhaps we will make some rapid progress, change, hope, and all that. 2. The content cartel and its enablers. There is no denying we want high-quality professional content all over the Internet. And it'd be fair to criticize the Clue Train Manifesto for overemphasizing the importance of conversation over content. Not every good idea on the Internet is a conversation. We never said it was. But most often, content on the net comes wrapped in conversation. Consider the hundreds of millions of people who are giving up TV time to watch amateur YouTubes. A YouTube video is content, but YouTube, without the ability to comment and, more importantly, to recommend videos to others, wouldn't be YouTube. Or take the millions of people who watch credit card-sized versions of broadcast TV on their laptops while they talk in real time with others watching the same little windows. If you haven't watched a presidential debate that way, you will. We are so much more interesting than Wolf Blitzer and the best political team on television. Talking about, and over, around, and through, content is one way we appropriate it. It's how we absorb it. That's why digital rights management techniques hold back culture. They keep content at an arm's distance, and that arm is holding a legal gun. We thus can't absorb it or make it culturally our own. That's why there is no market demand for DRM. It's always imposed on us. We want to be able to use the stuff we buy, transfer it from our iPod to our laptop to our DVR. We want to be able to do remixes that enhance or ridicule what the mass market is giving us. It's confusing and difficult because this isn't a struggle over property, like the owner of a beach house who tries to get an injunction to keep teenagers from swimming there. This is an ontological struggle. The nature of content as property is changing before our eyes, all part of an even larger rejiggering of privacy, culture, and collaboration. Folk art is in resurgence, but via a medium more mass than any we've seen so far. There is the possibility of soaking the earth with music we make, borrow, and reuse. Meanwhile, we are stuck in economic and legal systems that work well for atoms and not so well for connected bits. There are signs of movement away from locked-down machines and locked-down content, although there are simultaneous movements in the other direction. Perhaps someday soon we'll even get the new conversation about copyright that we so desperately need. In the meantime, we should take heart from the new sense on the web that sharing is the norm and that collaborating is a natural act. 3. Governments. The access providers and content cartel are looking out for their own interests, but the government's security forces are looking out for ours. If they say they need users to sign in with an ID number and a fingerprint, or if they say that they cannot tolerate encrypted communications, politicians are likely to cave in so they can't be held responsible for the non-prevention of the next attack. That's why the price of freedom is eternal vigilance, eternal, constant, grinding, scary vigilance. This is going to be a long, difficult struggle. I believe we'll only succeed if we supporters of openness are willing to lose some of our old instincts, just as we're asking the security forces of the world to lose some of theirs. When machines can process our packets, the chief problem is not that another person will see us naked, but that the machines are really stupid, so innocent people may be threatened and speech overall is chilled. One solution is not to totally ban the machine surveillance, but to tightly control what happens when a machine thinks it's found something suspicious. I don't know what the solution is, but we need to be prepared to engage in a lifelong struggle for our open Internet. 4. Marketers. The original Clue Train told us what we need to do to prevent marketers from subverting our conversations. We need to talk with one another. We need to trust one another more than we trust them. We need to continue to evolve mechanisms for exposing conversational predators. We need to continue to innovate trust mechanisms that are appropriate to the nature of the engagement, stricter if money is changing hands, looser if people are just blabbing about stuff. The good news is that lots of marketers have already figured out that conversational crime doesn't pay. For example, the Word of Mouth Marketing Association started itself up with a strong code of ethics, and they've disciplined members who have violated it. We've made a good start. We need to continue being wary so long as the temptation to lie is among us. Yes, I'm talking about forever. 5. The digital divide. We have to try everything we can think of, everything that makes sense, and a bunch of things that seem to make no sense at all. Governments, municipalities, philanthropies, private industry, everything. Every form of connection, from laptops to $100 laptops, to mobile phones, to nano paint. Whatever it takes to get people connected, and then whatever it takes to get people to learn to get and make what they want from their new connectedness. Some of what we try will work, much will fail. What works will never work well enough, but it will have to be good enough. 6. People. Fortunately, we don't have to decide whether the Internet is making us more or less comfortable with diversity to know what to do about it. No matter how much the Internet is making us more open to differences, it is not enough and it will never be enough. Inertia is on the side of sticking with what and who you know. So we have to create sites like globalvoicesonline.org to entice Americans to listen to voices from around the world. We have to remember to pass around links to ideas we don't agree with. We have to restrain ourselves from passing too quickly over what we don't immediately appreciate. I still think the Internet overall increases our appreciation of difference, but I now think that it does not increase it enough by itself. We have to work on this, and we will always have to work on this. The solution to each of these 6 threats is work, struggle, fight, forever. For that, optimism is required, and the forever part means we have to go beyond optimism all the way to hope. That's different than what I thought when we were writing Clutrain. In that first edition, we seemed to think that although we wouldn't capture Fort Business without a fight, the Internet was a force invincible and inevitable. We were wrong about the invincible and inevitable part, but I still believe that history is on the side of the Internet for 2 reasons. First, each of the threats comes from the attempt to maintain the old scarcities in the face of the overwhelming abundance characteristic of the Internet. Access providers want to limit access so they can charge more for it. Content providers use copyright to impose an artificial scarcity on their goods. Governments want to limit access to thwart dangerous actors. Marketers want to control what we know about their products. And our own nature seems to want to limit us to that with which we are already familiar. 10 years after Clutrain, we know the Internet won't simply root around those limitations. But rooting around isn't the only tactic. Floodwaters don't root around the fences in the fields they overwhelm. Abundance has its own tactics, for it turns out that control doesn't scale. The curve of the cost of control rises faster than the curve of growth. There's hope that there is a point at which abundance eventually outspends control. Second, my most fundamental belief about the net, one at the heart of what I've thought and written about since I visited my first single-column plain-text web page in the ancient Mosaic browser, is that the web allows a fuller, more natural expression of who we are than mass culture does. At bottom, we are creatures who share a world with others we care about. There is no turning back from sharing and caring. Mr. Rogers had it right. And with hyperlinks, we have a technology well-suited to our best nature. I was an optimist in 1999. 10 years later, I am an optimist who feels he needs to defend optimism, and an optimist who believes we have to fight for the inevitable. Chapter 1. Internet Apocalypso by Christopher Locke. You set my desire, I trip through your wires. You too. Premature burial. We die. You will never hear those words spoken in a television ad. Yet this central fact of human existence colors our world and how we perceive ourselves within it. Life is too short, we say, and it is. Too short for office politics, for busy work and pointless paper chases, for jumping through hoops and covering our asses, for trying to please, to not offend, for constantly struggling to achieve some ever-receding definition of success. Too short as well for worrying whether we bought the right suit, the right breakfast cereal, the right laptop computer, the right brand of underarm deodorant. Life is too short because we die. Alone with ourselves, we sometimes stop to wonder what's important, really. Our kids, our friends, our lovers, our losses. Things change, and change is often painful. People get downsized, move away. The old neighborhood isn't what it used to be. Children get sick, get better, get bored, get on our nerves. They grow up hearing news of a world more frightening than anything in ancient fairy tales. The Wicked Witch won't really push you into the oven, honey, but watch out for AK-47s at recess. Amazingly, we learn to live with it. Human beings are incredibly resilient. We know it's all temporary, that we can't freeze the good times or hold back the bad. We roll with the punches, regroup, rebuild, pick up the pieces, take another shot. We come to understand that life is just like that, and this seemingly simple understanding is the seed of a profound wisdom. It is also the source of a deep hunger that pervades modern life, a longing for something entirely different from the reality reinforced by everyday experience. We long for more connection between what we do for a living and what we genuinely care about, for work that's more than clock-watching drudgery. We long for release from anonymity, to be seen as who we feel ourselves to be rather than as the sum of abstract metrics and parameters. We long to be part of a world that makes sense rather than accept the accidental alienation imposed by market forces too large to grasp, to even contemplate. And this longing is not mere wistful nostalgia, nor just some unreconstructed adolescent dream. It is living evidence of heart, of what makes us most human. But companies don't like us human. They leverage our longing for their own ends. If we feel inadequate, there's a product that will fill the hole, a bit of fetishistic magic that will make us complete. Perhaps a new car would do the trick. Maybe a trip to the Caribbean, or that new CD, or a nice shiny set of Ginsu steak knives. Anything, everything, just get more stuff. Our role is to consume. Of course, the new car alone is not enough. It must be made to represent something larger, much larger. The blonde draped over the hood looks so much better than the old lady bitching about the dishes. Surely she'd understand our secret needs, and if we showed up with her at the big golf game, wouldn't the guys be impressed? Yeah, gotta get one of those babies. This isn't about sex, it's about power, the greatest bait there ever was to seduce the powerless. Or take it one slice closer to the bone, leverage care. For the cost of a jar of peanut butter, you can be a great mom, the kind every kid would love to have. You can look out on your happy kids playing in that perfect suburban backyard and breathe a little sigh of contentment that life's so good with not a wicked witch in sight, just like on television. We die. And there's more than one way to get it over with. Advertising has some serving suggestions for your premature burial. Testing, testing. But what's this got to do with the internet? A lot. The net grew like a weed between the cracks in the monolithic steel and glass empire of traditional commerce. It was technically obscure, impenetrable, populated by geeks and wizards, loners, misfits. When I started using the internet, nobody gave a damn about it outside of a few big universities and the military-industrial complex they served. In fact, if you were outside that favored circle, you couldn't even log on. The idea that the internet would someday constitute the world's largest marketplace would have been laughable if anyone was entertaining such delusions back then. I began entertaining them publicly in 1992, and the laughter was long and loud. The net grew and prospered largely because it was ignored. It worked by different rules than the rules of business. Market penetration wasn't interesting because there was no market, unless it was a market for new ideas. The net was built by people who said things like, "What if we try this? Nope. What if we try that? Nope. What if we try this other thing? Well, hot damn, look at that." One of the hottest dams was the World Wide Web. It came out of efforts to create electronic footnotes, references between academic papers on high-energy physics that maybe a few dozen people in the entire world could actually understand. That's why now, when you turn on your TV, you see haveanotherbeer.com. Well, okay, a few things did happen in between. One of those things was that the internet attracted millions, many millions. The interesting question to ask is why? In the early 1990s, there was nothing like the internet we take for granted today. Back then, the net was primitive, daunting, uninviting. So what did we come for? And the answer is each other. The internet became a place where people could talk to other people without constraint, without filters or censorship or official sanction, and perhaps most significantly, without advertising. Another, non-commercial culture began forming across this out-of-the-way collection of computer networks. Long before graphical user interfaces made the scene was populated by plain old boring ASCII, green phosphor text scrolling up screens at the glacial pace afforded by early modems. So where was the attraction in that? The attraction was in speech, however mediated, in people talking, however slowly. and mostly the attraction lay in the kinds of things they were saying. Never in history had so many had the chance to know what so many others were thinking on such a wide range of subjects. Slowly at first, a new kind of conversation was beginning to emerge, but it would achieve global reach with astonishing speed. In the early days, the Internet was used almost exclusively for government-funded projects and the sort of communication that went along with such work. Here's the new program. It needs some work. There's a bug in the Frimular module. Yawn. But you know what they say about all work and no play. People began to play. Left to themselves, they always do. And the people building the Internet were pretty much left to themselves. They were creating the game board. No one else knew how the hell this thing worked, so no one could tell them what they could and couldn't do. They did whatever they liked, and one of the things they liked most was arguing. Consider that these early denizens of the net were, for the most part, young, brash, untrained in the intricate dance of corporate politics, and highly knowledgeable of their craft. In the prized and noble older sense of the term, they were hackers and proud of it. Many, in their own assessment, if not that of others, were net.gods, high priests of an arcane art very few even knew existed. When disagreements arose over serious matters, the correct use of quotation marks, say, they would join in the battle like old Norse warriors. Jim, you are a complete idiot. Your code is so brain-damaged it won't even compile. Read a book, moron. Today, we tend to think of flaming as a handful of people vociferously insulting each other online. A certain sense of finesse has largely been lost. In the olden days, a good flame war could go on for weeks or months with hot invective flying around like rhetorical shrapnel. It was high art, high entertainment. Though tempers flared hot and professional bridges were sometimes irreparably burned, ultimately it was a game, a participatory sport in which the audience awarded points for felicitous disparagements, particularly well-worded put-downs, inspired squelches. It was not a game, however, for the meek of heart. These engagements could be fierce. Even trying to separate the contestants could bring down a hail of sharp-tongued derision. Theories were floated and defended with extreme energy and enthusiasm, if not always with logical rigor. Opinions tended to run high on any given topic. Say you'd posted about your dog, and look, you got a response. Jim, you are a complete idiot. Your dog is so brain-damaged it won't even hunt. If you'd happened to see the first version of the comment to Jim, you might grin at the second. If not, your mileage might vary. But the point is not to extol flame wars, as amusing as some could be. Instead, it is to suggest a particular set of values that began to emerge in what linguists might call a well-bounded speech community. On the net, you said what you meant and had better be ready to explain your position and how you'd arrived at it. Mouthing platitudes guaranteed that you would be challenged. Nothing was accepted at face value or taken for granted. Everything was subject to question, revision, re-implementation, parody, whether it was an algorithm, a political philosophy, or, God help you, an advertisement. While the outcome of these debates did not invariably constitute wisdom for the ages, the process by which they took place was honing a razor-sharp sense of collective potential. The conversation was not only engaging, interesting, exciting, it was effective. Tools and techniques emerged with a speed that broke all precedents. As would soon become obvious, the net was a powerful multiplier for intellectual capital. Waiting for Joe Sixpack. A few years ago, you could make an interesting distinction between people who thought there was something special about the Internet and those who saw it as no big deal. Now, of course, everybody sees it as a big deal, mostly because of those weird ball IPOs and the overnight billionaires they've spawned. But I think the distinction is still valid. Most companies with net.dollar signs in their eyes today are still missing the something special dimension. Yahoo has already made it, financially speaking, but forms a good example nonetheless. Despite the funky hacker roots of the initial directory Yang and Philo built, Yahoo now describes itself as a, quote, global media company, unquote, thus claiming a closer spiritual kinship with Disney and Murdoch than with the culture that originally put it on the map. To this mindset, the net is just an extension of preceding mass media, primarily television. The rhetoric it uses is freighted with the same crypto-religious marketing jargon that characterized broadcast. Brand, market share, eyeballs, demographics. And guess what? It works. If nobody was getting rich off this stuff, you wouldn't hear about it. It's the fast new companies that are reaping these monetary rewards. But guess what again? They're reaping them from an even faster market, one that, for the most part, has only discovered the Internet in the last year or so. The people who make up this new market naturally bring a lot of baggage from their previous experience of mass media. To someone who just got an AOL account last Christmas, I suppose a web page looks like a very slow TV show. But this is where the something special effect comes in. It is assumed in some quarters that if you missed the early days of Usenet and didn't use links from a Unix command line, you missed the magic of Internet culture. I don't think so. Sure, those were very different days, and there was a certain fervor, almost a fever, that was hard to mistake for sitcom fandom. But I think the Internet still has a radicalizing effect today, despite all the banner ads and promotional hype and you-may-already-be-a-winner sweepstakes. The something special is what the manifesto calls voice. Imagine for a moment millions of people sitting in their shuttered homes at night, bathed in that ghostly blue television aura. They're passive, yeah, but more than that, they're isolated from each other. Now imagine another magic wire strung from house to house, hooking all those poor bastards up. They're still watching the same old crap. Then, during the touching love scene, some joker lobs an off-color aside, and everybody hears it. Whoa, what was that? People are rolling on the floor laughing. And it begins to happen so often it gets abbreviated, ROTFL. The audience is suddenly connected to itself. What was once the show, the hypnotic focus and TV advertising carrier wave, becomes, in the context of the Internet, a sort of reverse new media MacGuffin, an excuse to get together rather than an excuse not to. Think of Joel and the bots on Mystery Science Theater 3000. The point is not to watch the film, but to outdo each other making fun of it. And for such radically realigned purposes, some bloated corporate website can serve as a target every bit as well as Godzilla, King of the Monsters. As the remake trailer put it, size does matter. So here comes Joe Sixpack onto AOL. What does he know about netliness? Nothing. Zilch. He has no cultural context whatsoever. But soon, very soon, what he hears is something he never heard in TV land, people cracking up. That ain't no laugh track, neither, Joe is thinking, and goes looking for the source of this strange, new, rather seductive sound. So here's a little story problem for you, class. If the Internet has 50 million people on it, and they're not all as dumb as they look, but the corporations trying to make a fast buck off their asses are as dumb as they look, how long before Joe is laughing as hard as everyone else? The correct answer, of course, not long at all. And as soon as he starts laughing, he's not Joe Sixpack anymore. He's no longer part of some passive couch potato target demographic. Because the net connects people to each other and impassions and empowers through those connections, the media dream of the web as another acquiescent mass consumer market is a figment and a fantasy. The Internet is inherently seditious. It undermines unthinking respect for centralized authority, whether that authority is the neatly homogenized voice of broadcast advertising or the smarmy rhetoric of the corporate annual report. And Internet technology has also threaded its way deep into the heart of corporate empire, where once upon a time, lockstep loyalty to the chairman's latest attempt at insight was no further away than the mimeograph machine. One memo from Mr. Big and everyone believed, or so Mr. Big liked to think. No more. The same kind of seditious deconstruction that's being practiced on the web today, just for the hell of it, is also seeping onto the company intranet. How many satires are floating around there, one wonders, of the latest hyper-inflated restructuring plan, of the oversincere cultural sensitivity training sessions human resources made mandatory last week, of all the gibberish that passes for management or has passed up until now? Step back a frame or two. Zoom out. Isn't that weird? Workers and markets are speaking the same language, and they're both speaking it in the same shoot-from-the-hip, unedited, devil-take-the-hindmost style. This conversation may be irreverent of eternal verities, but it's not all jokes. Whether in the marketplace or at work, people do have genuine, serious concerns. And we have something else as well, knowledge. Not the sort of boring, abstract knowledge that knowledge management wants to manage. No, the real thing. We have knowledge of what we do and how we do it, our craft, and it drives our voices. It's what we most like to talk about. But this whole gamut of conversation, from infinite jest to point-specific expertise, who needs it? Companies need it. Without it, they can't innovate, build consensus, or go to market. Markets need it. Without it, they don't know what works and what doesn't. Don't know why they should give a damn. Cultures need it. Without play and knowledge in equal measure, they begin to die. People get gloomy, anxious, and depressed. Eventually, the guns come out. There are two new conversations going on today, both vibrant and exciting, both mediated by internet technologies but having little to do with technology otherwise. Unfortunately, there's also a metaphorical firewall separating these conversations, and that wall is the traditional, conservative, fearful corporation. So what is to be done? Easy. Burn down business as usual. Bulldoze it. Cordon off the area. Set up barricades. Cripple the tanks. Topple the statues of heroes too long dead into the street. Sound familiar? You bet it does. And the message has been the same all along, from Paris in 68 to the Berlin Wall, from Warsaw to Tiananmen Square. Let the kids rock and roll. So open the windows and turn up the volume. If the noise gets loud enough, maybe even CNN will cover. From ancient markets to global networks. This may seem rabidly anti-business. It's not. Business is just a word for buying and selling things. In one way or another, we all rely on this commerce, both to get the things we want or need and to afford them. We are alternately the workers who create products and services and the customers who purchase them. There is nothing inherently wrong with this setup, except when it becomes all of life, except when life becomes secondary and subordinate. At the beginning of the 21st century, business so dominates all other aspects of our existence that it's hard to imagine it was ever otherwise, but it was. Imagine it. Storylines. A few thousand years ago, there was a marketplace, never mind where. Traders returned from far seas with spices, silks, and precious magical stones. Caravans arrived across burning deserts bringing dates and figs, snakes, parrots, monkeys, strange music, stranger tales. The marketplace was the heart of the city, the kernel, the hub, the amphalos. Like past and future, it stood at the crossroads. People woke early and went there for coffee and vegetables, eggs and wine, for pots and carpets, rings and necklaces, for toys and sweets, for love, for rope, for soap, for wagons and carts, for bleeding goats and evil-tempered camels. They went there to look and listen and to marvel, to buy and be amused, but mostly they went to meet each other and to talk. In the market, language grew, became bolder, more sophisticated, leaped and sparked from mind to mind. Incited by curiosity and rapt attention, it took astounding risks that none had ever dared to contemplate, built whole civilizations from the ground up. Markets are conversations. Trade routes paved the storylines. Across the millennia in between, the human voice is the music we have always listened for and still best understand. So what went wrong? From the perspective of corporations, many of which by the 20th century had become bigger and far more powerful than ancient city-states, nothing went wrong. But things did change. Commerce is a natural part of human life, but it has become increasingly unnatural over the intervening centuries, incrementally divorcing itself from the people on whom it most depends, whether workers or customers. While this change is in many ways understandable, huge factories took the place of village shops, the marketplace moved from the center of the town and came to depend on far-flung mercantile trade, the result has been to interpose a vast chasm between buyers and sellers. By our own lifetimes, mass production and mass media had totally transformed this relationship, which came to be characterized by alienation and mystery. Exactly what relationship did producers and markets have to each other anymore? In attempting to answer this blind man's buff question, market research became a billion-dollar industry. Once an intrinsic part of the local community, commerce has evolved to become the primary force shaping the community of nations on a global scale. But because of its increasing divorce from the day-to-day concerns of real people, commerce has come to ignore the natural conversation that defines communities as human. The slow pace of this historic change has made it seem unsurprising to many that people are now valued primarily for their capacity to consume, as targets for product pitches, as demographic abstractions. Few living in the so-called civilized world today can envision commerce as ever having been anything different. But much of the change happened in the century just past. Economies of scale, mo bigger, mo better. The Internet is often seen as a unique phenomenon that only recently burst into the economic mainstream. But looking at the net in strictly technological terms obscures its relationship to broader economic trends that were already well underway. By the end of the 19th century, the United States was poised to become the prototypical mass market. It had vast natural resources, a fast-growing population, and a contiguous geography generally unbounded by tariff restrictions. Cheap iron, coupled with a voracious appetite for industrial expansion, enabled a railway system capable of cost-effectively delivering goods to nearly every part of a captive domestic market. Given the high cost of entry into such enterprises, and without appreciable foreign competition, manufacturers cared little about product differentiation. Thus Henry Ford's attitude toward customer choice: they can have any color they want as long as it's black. More than for his wit, Ford is remembered for designing the first high-volume automotive assembly lines. The more cars Ford could make, the lower the unit cost and the greater the margin of profit. These economies of scale led to enormous profits because they enabled selling a far cheaper product to a far wider market. Ford was strongly influenced by Frederick Taylor and his theory of scientific management. Taylor's time and motion metrics sought to bring regularity and predictability to bear on the increasingly detailed division of labor. Under such a regimen, previously holistic craft expertise rapidly degraded into the mindless execution of single repetitive tasks, with each worker performing only one operation in the overall process. Because of its effect on workers' knowledge, de-skilling is a term strongly associated with mass production. And as skill disappeared, so did the unique voice of the craftsman. The organization was elegantly simple, if not terribly humane. Atop the management hierarchy resided near omniscient knowledge of products and manufacturing methods. In the case of Ford, product design, process design, marketing strategy, and other critical functions were chiefly the province of one man, Henry. This knowledge was translated into work orders that were executed by an increasingly layered cadre of lieutenants who directed a large but largely unskilled workforce. This style of command and control management worked best for single product lines with few parts and simple processes. Economies of scope. Would you like fries with that? Mass production, mass marketing, and mass media have constituted the holy trinity of American business for at least 100 years. The payoffs were so huge that the mindset became an addiction, a drug blinding its users to changes that began to erode the old axioms attaching to economies of scale. These changes were gradual at first. Even early on, economies of scope began to be perceived. General Motors broke Ford's run on the Model T, an impossibly long product cycle by today's standards, by offering cars that were not black and even came in different styles to suit different tastes and pocketbooks. Heinz discovered it could make not just, say, mustard, but 57 varieties of condiments in the same factory. Consumers began to have a wider range of choice, and they warmed quickly to their new options. But things got more complicated on the management side. As more products were launched, organizations became increasingly bureaucratic and business functions more isolated from each other. This was de-skilling of a higher order. Design, production, and marketing knowledge began to fractionate, and in some cases to atrophy. The real watershed came when offshore producers, finally recovered from the Second World War, began to penetrate U.S. markets. With the oil embargo of the early 1970s, small, fuel-efficient cars began looking highly attractive to people stalled in long gas lines. Companies like Honda, Toyota, and Volkswagen exploded into the North American market like a tsunami. The challenge to U.S. manufacturers was not to offer just trivial feature alternatives, but whole new designs. In a classic reversal, what was suddenly good for America was anything but good for General Motors. The auto industry didn't see these changes coming, and as a result, lost enormous market share to offshore competitors. Overnight, global competition turned mass markets into thousands of micro-markets. Nike now makes hundreds of different styles of shoes. The Wall Street Journal coined the term sneakerization to describe a phenomenon affecting nearly every industry. Competition is healthy, we'd been told from birth, because it breeds greater choice. But now competition was out of control, and old guard notions of brand allegiance evaporated like mist in the rising sun onslaught from Japan, Southeast Asia, and Europe.